Muhammad said, two joys are prepared for him who observes the fast, the joy of breaking the fast and that of meeting his Lord. I read this in Stephen Harrod Buhner's book, The Transformational Power of Fasting, The Way to Spiritual, Physical, and Emotional Rejuvenation. Stephen is quite well known as an award-winning author and as an earth poet. I would call him earth poetry. He's living with a conscious rhythm of nature, which we all know will make him very, very wise. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Stephen, I'm on to you. You know, your creativity prevents you from using the same title over and over, but the transformational power of whatever is all you need to do to start weaving any number of inspirational tapestries. Your writing is amazing, and you weave so much into any topic, so it really does speak to the depth and breadth of us as human beings.
Thanks, Robin. I mean, my focus on a lot of this stuff is really all of the things I'm interested in, they have to do with how to become more fully yourself, to become more fully a human being. And so it's kind of like a thread that's dangling out of a sweater or something. If you start pulling on whatever thread you encounter, it always gets back to that deep relationship to the self and the self to the world around us. So part of the problem for me about a lot of stuff, especially nonfiction writing, which is mainly what I do, is that they just stay on the surface so much. And that, if being superficial would make us have a happier life, all of us would be incredibly happy right now.
Well, we can hope for that anyway, and if we can get more into the system like the way you write, I think the odds are with us ultimately here. Well, you called your research for this book about fasting provocative and intriguing. What brought you to those conclusions?
Well, some of the things about fasting, I mean, the United States experienced its first huge sort of new age movement, which included a lot of work with fasting in the around 1880 or so. There was after the Civil War and things began to calm down a little, the Northeast was going through this massive sort of renaissance similar to the 60s and 70s of the last century. And they did a lot of really neat stuff, but then that sort of died out, and as everybody got more mechanically oriented around medicine and stuff, and the whole focus then began to be very physical, and a lot of the books on fasting, they were just about, they were sort of fundamentalist, you know, things about what you had to eat or to be a good person and all this stuff, and there was a lot of sort of abuse of the body involved in the whole thing. And it sort of just kind of flowed through, but nobody'd really looked at what's the emotional relationship to food, for instance. And there was no book on fasting that I'd read that even talked about that. But for every one of us, food probably has one of the deepest emotional connotations that of anything. So for a lot of people, when you quit eating, because people experience food as love or food as nurturing, when you quit eating, they experience it as a loss of that. And so it becomes extremely difficult to fast in a healthy way because of that psychological dynamic. So looking at that was fairly provocative. And another part of it was there's this huge belief, it's really strange, one of these urban myths that, you know, and I read it in books all the time, you know, a plane crashes in the desert and they don't have food, and that's fine because you can survive a long time without food, but you can only survive like, you know, 3 minutes without water or whatever the time limit is. But in those fasting dynamics back in the 1880s to about 1915 or so, they did some amazing work with people that were doing dry fasts and they would go 2-3 weeks without any water at all. So that sort of realization, it's very provocative in terms of what everybody believes to be true.
Sure. And what do you think it was about this time, Stephen, that had them doing these studies?
Well, it was just a really, really interesting time in the United States. We tend to go through this about every, 80 years or so, or 100 years, something like that. The United States goes through this incredibly amazing spark of innovation and thinking outside the box. And at that period of time, yoga was first brought into the United States. Buddhism was big. Unitarianism was starting. All of Ralph Waldo Emerson's work was becoming very popular. So there was just a huge sort of exploration of human potential that was occurring at the time. And one of the things they got into, I would presume because of the yoga coming into the United States, was that concept of fasting. And that's where Kellogg's got started. Kellogg, cornflakes, which
sure.
was originally, a health food cereal, and a lot of things like that. And a lot of the drinks that we take for granted, 7-Up, which was... had lithium in it, so it raised your spirits, or Coca-Cola or Dr. Pepper, they were all health drinks, really. And this huge health food movement, so fasting was a very deep part of that. And they didn't have the kind of reductionistic preconceptions we have now, so they explored it in amazing ways.
Yes. Well, you mentioned, of course, the ancient traditions of yoga and how fasting is directly in with that. What are some of the ancient fasts, and were they very different than what are being practiced today?
Well, there wasn't as much fear. That's probably one of the biggest differences between now and 100 years ago, even 50, 60 years ago. Our entire American culture now is so oriented around fear, and there's such a huge focus on safety that you can't really do anything other than sit in front of your couch. And maybe soon couches will have warning labels on them. Warning, if you sit too long, you'll be really immensely fat or something. I don't know. But
they're outlawed in Boulder.
Everything has some sort of a warning about it. And so whenever you start to read anything, they've got some doctor that they go to or some researcher that goes, warning, warning, pencils can put out your eye, therefore, don't use pencils or something. And that is just the major difference I see. Back then, it was assumed that life is inherently unsafe. And yeah, you can minimize risk, but you can't get rid of it. So there was a greater sense of exploration and a willingness to take those kind of risks. And now the fear level is just much higher than I've ever seen it in any historical study I've looked at.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just speaking to Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he was relating that to the fact that the more we use our intellect as opposed to our heart intelligence, we're solving problems more, but at the same time creating more fear. And then it just goes in, well, I know how to fix that. And then, but we're really more and more and more separating ourselves from that true intelligence of the heart.
Yeah, we are. And one of the things that I talk about in a number of my books is, the human body has three incredibly powerful biological oscillators in it. The three strongest are the brain, the heart, and the GI tract. And of those, the brain is the least strong. I mean, basically what it is, it's an organic computer. It's just designed to process data. It's not designed to make us more human or help us be more human or more moral or more ethical or anything else, or happier, But, one of the interesting things I've been noticing now, for instance, with the GI tract, because it produces a huge electromagnetic field around the body, and I've been, thinking for quite a long time about what is its function. And basically what it does, in Chinese medicine, it's related, the brain and the GI tract are related to each other because the GI tract breaks things apart just like the mind breaks things apart into pieces. whereas the heart tends to put things together into holes. But the fascinating thing about the GI tract is, and I talk about the trust of the body a lot in this particular book, and how we've lost that relationship to trust ourselves. But what the GI tract does, and these guys have studied it in a number of different living organisms, like bees, for instance, that the field will touch another field of a food plant, for instance, or a food you're going to eat or something, and it will then, it's able to determine how safe the food is for you by simply analyzing the electromagnetic field of the food that you're encountering. So it's this sort of very finely honed evolutionary survival tool that's been developed over, you know, millions of years in all living organisms.
And
so if you trust your body, then whenever you encounter a new food that you're wondering about eating, it will actually go through an analysis process and give you extremely sophisticated information about its level of safety, how good it is, and all of that. So it's just a phenomenal dynamic.
And once you can zero in on that, it's just, it becomes fantastic, because it really does throw out the whole, well, this is good for you, this isn't good for you. Because it must truly be an completely individual process.
It is a completely individual process. I mean, we're not ants, you know, even though we tend to act like it sometimes. The thing is that everybody's body ecology is different from everybody else's, and we have an individual relationship with food in the world around us. And so one of the real problems that we've gotten into is this belief that it's possible to have one-picture answers to everything, that this is the answer, and if we just behave this way all of the time, we'll be safe. So, you know, if we only eat like this, then we'll live to be a million years old and we'll never have any diseases. You know, it's an absurd belief, as if death can be got rid of. Well, it can't. We're supposed to biodegrade. We're biodegrading right now, and that's the way the world is supposed to work. You know, it's just, you know, biodegrading is fine, except when it comes to me. You know, a lot of people get nervous when it gets that close. As Woody Allen said, you know, I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Right.
So, but that thing, that trust of the body is essential in getting away from the brain, instituting these sort of top-down rules we've picked up from people that don't really have any relationship to the world. So, you know, one of the studies I talk about in this book that's fascinating, they took two groups of children, very similar to each other in, you know, health and age and, you know, financial status and everything. And one group, they, you know, like, you eat, clean your plate and eat these three meals a day. And the other group, they were allowed to eat whatever they wanted without any restriction, you know, whatever they wanted to have. If they wanted to eat ice cream for a month, they could eat ice cream for a month. Hot dogs every day for a year, fine. Well, it turned out that that group began to trust their body, and this was like a massive exploration process that occurred. And once they sort of correlated it and they trusted their body, they began to eat what was the most healthy things for them. And later in life, they developed virtually no eating disorders, whereas the first group developed the full range of eating disorders that we tend to see in the American population, because they were literally trained not to trust what their body wanted to eat, because they were being basically taught not to trust their body by saying, no, you can't eat that, you have to eat this. No, this is good for you. No, that's bad for you. So it confuses that innate body intelligence. And that sort of dynamic occurs really in every facet of American culture now. We're trained never to trust ourselves. And so I suppose one of my biggest messages continually in all my books and in this one is, we got to start trusting ourselves. I mean, it's just the options are horrible if we don't.
Yes.
We're never happy.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, you mentioned earlier about the fast, the dry fast, and I'm sure some people were kind of aghast, almost literally. And so I don't think we can just gloss over that. You mention in your book also that the body is evolutionarily designed to fast, and maybe you can speak about that a little bit and tell us about that dry fast a little bit.
Well, those are kind of two separate things. The evolutionarily designed to fast, I mean, you have to understand that we have emerged out of the ecological matrix of this planet, and only about 10% of our genome can be referred to as distinctly human. That was like sort of the innovation. The rest of our genome is the same as it is in viruses and plants and everything else. So the last universal common ancestor from which everything diverged was bacterial, and that learning is encoded in all of our bodies. So all organisms go through periods of food deprivation where, for whatever reason, there's not enough food availability. And a long, long time ago, organisms began to build into their structure ways to deal with that. And oddly enough, it turns out that if we do some sort of a fast, it doesn't have to be a water fast, for instance, or even a dry fast. It can be just like a juice fast or really a really reduced diet. By doing that once or twice a year, our whole body's thermostat begins to be reset. It appeared that not only did organisms learn to live through periods of low food availability and do it well, that those periodic times of low food availability, the organism actually needed it to go through sort of a detox process and to sort of reset the whole internal thermostat. And it became very healthy. I mean, it's like turning a thing that was a negative into this positive growth attribute, which is, you know, just a brilliant evolutionary innovation. So that's one thing. And then the dry fast, there was this great book they used to call fasting inanition, I think was the word. You know, it's not what I normally, inanition or inanition, something like that. And it just meant to not eat. They had to use big words. So, but they had these physicians around, I think it was the Smithsonian or the Carnegie Institute, one that funded this huge study, and the book's like, you know, 1,000 pages long. But they had these people that were professional fasters from that 1880, 1890, 1900 period, and they would be in this room and monitored by physicians the entire time, and they would just simply not drink any water for, let's say, 2 weeks as part of the fast. They wouldn't use anything. And they were monitored the entire time, and they were just completely healthy. There was no sort of side effect from it at all. I mean, you have low energy when you do that. You just sort of lay around. It's not like you're jogging or anything. But the kind of negative impacts that we're trained to believe are going to happen, they just didn't see them. And the records were great. So you take that into now. I mean, even if you mention fasting to most medically trained doctors in the United States with water or however you want to do it, they just don't get it. In general, the majority of them think it's a very dangerous practice, and they really don't know much about it. So we've got kind of a weird belief system, and I think the water part of it's just the most extreme version of it, really.
Sure, and it is a case like many things that aren't mainstream Western medicine. You know, they'll say, don't do this without your doctor observing you, and yet your doctor has no idea about what he's even supposed to be looking for at this point.
None at all. And like the two deaths, there were very few deaths from fasting, but two of them occurred because they were being, you know, supervised by physicians who gave them the wrong diet to break the fast after a very long water fast, and they died as a result. So it's like, just because these guys went to school for a long time to study pharmacology doesn't mean they know anything about stuff outside their field. They just don't. It's like asking a rocket ship designer to figure out how to plant a garden. It's not the same thing.
Right. I would have to add here, unless you were that rocket scientist.
Thanks.
Well, Stephen, what was your longest fast? In days?
Water fasts have gotten progressively harder for me as I've gotten older. I have a lot of pain in my hips. Any place I'm having wear in the joints tends to be rather excruciatingly painful. So I don't tend to do those anymore. I might do it for a day or two in the middle of a longer fast, but I think the longest I've ever gone is 2 weeks, and that as sort of a 2 week juice fast with a couple of days in the middle of just liquids. That's about what I do. That's optimum for me.
Yeah, I found that when I set out to do a fast, I haven't even done it in the last few years. So I've just found that kind of interesting that, you know, in my younger days, it was easier mentally and physically to do that.
Yeah, I think that I don't really know why. I mean, I could just presume the degree of vitality and resilience I had when I was 20 just made it a lot different to do almost everything than at 60 now. And I think in part because I didn't do water fasts regularly through much of my life, it's just a harder dynamic on me for whatever reason. Or it could just be my individual inclinations, my own individual physiology. You know, some people can do them quite long, quite well, but most of the ones I've talked to that do have been doing them for many years.
Yes. Tell us about deep fasting and then perhaps move into how it brings heart intelligence to the forefront, taking mental intelligence out of the driver's seat for a while.
Well, one of the really interesting things, and I quoted a lot of great fasters, you know, among them Gandhi, but there's neat fasting tidbits of wisdom, you know, scattered through literature everywhere. And the thing is, it's broadly stated in every tradition that fasting makes the heart of the faster more sensitive to the world. And basically what happens as you begin to fast, the brain, which normally uses glucose for energy, begins to shift to a more fat-based metabolism, like we were in as babies when we were feeding on breast milk. It's more similar to that. And that fat-based metabolism, which the good thing about it is your body begins using up your fat stores, which is why it's good for weight loss. And that sort of fuel, it really runs the brain differently than glucose, which is a much more kind of hyperadrenaline sort of fuel. And you begin shifting out of the head, you begin going much slower, and you begin to be incredibly aware of all of the sensory inputs that are coming in, most especially how things feel. You know, the response of the heart to what's presented to the senses starts to become extremely acute. And that was one of the major reasons that fasting was considered good. See, just in a physiological sense, it begins healing all kinds of heart disease. It's one of the best things for heart disease to fast. But what's also fascinating is that it heals the dissociation that we have between our head and our heart, which, in my opinion, is one of the major causes of heart disease in the West anyway. People that restore heart perception and begin to move into the heart as their primary organ of perception, where the brain then becomes, it begins to synchronize with the heart oscillations rather than the other way around, they automatically have healthier heart function. There's been a lot of great, really detailed studies on that. For me, that's the beginning of going into what I consider a deep fast, where you're moving beyond the surface of things, the surface sensory inputs that you get every day that you're processing mentally, and you start to experience what this German poet Gottfried Benn called the metaphysical background of the world. You start to feel the deeper meanings that are in everything, and that's one of the major important things about doing these deeper fasts, not just for healing and health, but for a sense of personal direction, where you start to leave the superficial behind and deal with the deeper meanings in your life and in the world, and it begins to reorient the individual to a deeper sort of meaningful relationship with their own life and with the world, and they get a better sense of direction. So that, you know, very specifically, Native American vision quests are focused around that, but it's common in every tradition. And that thing, that process, I mean, it takes a lot of focus because you know you're going to be engaging with not only wonderful experiences, but also the shadow side of things, the deep fears that you might have, the mistakes that you've made in your life choices when you begin to look at what do I really want to do with my life. And it's that deep quest for meaning that's crucial to everybody.
Yes. Would you say that the major physiological function shift that happens during a fast, as opposed, for instance, to a diet scenario, is that which you were just speaking about with the shift of fuel and then the heart shifting?
Yeah, that's the major difference. And it's also a diet thing is, diets are generally concerned with surfaces. You know, people diet because they want to look better, and they want to look better so that they'll be prettier and fit in and be loved more. So, I mean, you've got that whole psychological cultural frame which powers most diets. You know, I very rarely ever hear somebody say, I'm dieting because I want to be more healthy. They usually say, I'm dieting because I've gained too much weight and I'm not fitting in my clothes and I look like a dweeb. So I want to look, you know, I want to look like that woman on the TV or that guy that was pumping iron, you know. So that, just that focus in a diet, it's dealing with what I consider to be some of the more negative dynamics in our culture about personal appearance. And when you switch to that you're fasting and you're doing a deep fast, which has very strong emotional connotations as well as spiritual connotations, you're not so much looking at that anymore. You're going into this deeper thing, and that, and oddly enough, and sort of, you know, wonderfully enough, the deeper fast itself facilitates that movement into meaning work. And so, yeah, it's very different than a diet.
Well, I'm interested to hear you talk about the nonlinear dynamics of organ systems and perhaps how fasting assists in that balance.
One of the great discoveries, I mean, people have known it for a long time. They just didn't, most scientists just didn't want to pay attention to it, and most of them still don't, is that the world is not a linear place, A to B to C. It's not, it's never has been, it's never going to be. But that belief that we can understand cause and effect and then begin to control the exterior world to make it completely manageable and safe to human beings, it pervades not only our culture, but nearly every scientific discipline. And the thing that's turning out is that nonlinearity is the rule. In other words, that, for instance, if you have, let's say you're somebody that's never been in cold weather, okay, in Africa somewhere. They've never been in cold weather. They've never seen ice. They don't know anything about it. They just know water. If they were watching water and you're slowly reducing the temperature of the water, and all of a sudden it hits 32 degrees Fahrenheit and it totally changes state from liquid to solid, there's no way that a human being could predict that that was going to happen. What you're seeing is a sudden phase change at a certain moment in time that can't be predicted very easily until you sort of know about it afterwards. I mean, it seems obvious to us now, but that's exactly what nonlinearity is like. You get outcomes that can't be predicted by looking at previous states or parts of things. So when you get things combining together, you get these tremendous outcomes that don't have anything to do with linear cause and effect thinking. So our organs, like the temperature in our body is not 98.6. I mean, that's just a lie. That's an average. But our body temperature is changing constantly from microsecond to microsecond to microsecond based on shifts in functioning, shifts in its response to the external world. It's really very much like riding a bicycle or riding a unicycle is even better, or juggling. So the juggler, you know, the juggler, whatever they're juggling is in one place, the juggler's in another, that's just the parts. But when they pick up and they start juggling, it becomes a unified system. And from that moment on, the juggler begins responding to tiny perturbations of that balance point that he has to process below the level of conscious awareness. So he begins sort of moving around the room. His hands move in these different ways. And you can never predict what response he's going to make to those tiny perturbations. That's a very simple look at nonlinearity. And all of our organ systems are doing that continually. So our GI tract is constantly monitoring its interior world and its exterior world and shifting its responses, its functioning, and its state from millisecond to millisecond. Our heart does the same thing. Every organ does the same thing. And that's why that old 19th, early 20th century picture of the body as a mechanical system made up of, you know, replaceable parts, it just doesn't work in the real world. It's not accurate. And that's why saying, you know, you have to eat these foods every day to be healthy, it's just not accurate to the real world. We constantly are changing and shifting, and the world around us is constantly changing and shifting. And though we can predict to a certain extent, ultimately, we're going to experience massive phase shifts from time to time that we can never predict. So by getting into the feeling basis of things and trusting our body, it allows us to be a lot more adaptable every minute of the day rather than, you know, being a mind that's dragging this hulking body around with us that we are offended by.
Yes, and this question will be sort of absurd right now following that, but I feel like since we are talking about fasting, I would be remiss perhaps to not ask if there's any condition that's an obvious do not fast condition. And of course, that intuitive hit of not a good idea for me right now or ever is perhaps the most valid. But are there disease conditions where throughout history it's just been, yeah, not a good idea?
There are a number, and I list them all in the book. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say pregnant mothers shouldn't fast, but, you know, they actually do around the world a lot. The one of the primary ones that's most difficult for people and that is, you know, a lot of caution is warranted is type 1 diabetics. There's a couple of other conditions where people have difficulty actually shifting to a fat-based fuel in the body and in the brain because it's a genetic problem where they can't actually do that. I do list those in there. Those are the major sort of physiological things. Children don't usually need to fast because they're a lot more resilient and healthy. They don't usually need to fast as long if they do fast. You know, people that are severely anorexic or starving, obviously, hello, they shouldn't really fast. And people that are whose self-worth is so heavily involved in food preparation and eating, I mean, beyond just the normal neuroses all of us have about it, it's very difficult for them to fast. So that's sort of a brief overview of those conditions. In general, most people can.
Yeah, and maybe in closing, Stephen, you could just talk about human disease from any avenue or aspect you care to right now.
Well, the weird thing is human disease is a relationship. Most people don't understand that, you know, one of the things about people, about little babies crawling around and putting stuff in their mouth, one of the things they're doing there is training their GI tract awareness about the nature of things in the world. And, you know, doctors and researchers have also said that are knowledgeable about this. They say, well, the immune system starts becoming a lot more healthy once that happens. And I've seen a lot of different disease dynamics happen for people. I mean, there's acute diseases that have to be responded to a certain way, but all of us encounter chronic diseases. And one of the primary functions for chronic diseases that I've seen is to enhance the awareness of the person who's sick. And that thing, approaching it without fear, but directly as if it's a teacher, is one of the most life-changing things I've ever seen. In the Lyme community, for instance, it's changed so many people's lives that way, and their stories are absolutely phenomenal. So the thing is, it's like this one of the most intimate relationships a human being can have. When they get a disease, they're becoming intimate with that disease, and there's a conversation that occurs. So, you know, the use of fasting or plant medicines or whatever, it's a part of that process. And For me, I wouldn't have been the way I am if I hadn't gotten sick a number of times. It's what changed everything, especially once your life is saved by a plant, you never go back. It's everything's different for that.
I like that. That's the first time I've heard that, you never go back when your life is changed by a plant. But what a perfect note to finish with you, Stephen, and you're just so fun, and it's such a pleasure always.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
Nature at its best. Stephen Buhner, author of The Transformational Power of Fasting and other really great books. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly notices of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.